How many of you have felt imposter syndrome around polyamory?
Oh, if you want this, that means I'm not enough.
You just need to not be jealous. You need to not have these feelings.
No one's doing this very well.
Am I doing monogamy right?
Mm-hmm. No, monogamy? No more.
Fuck no. Fuck no.
It's only successful if one of you dies.
That was 0 to 100.
And I liked it.
Ooh. What's going on, everybody? Welcome back to the Queer Collective Podcast. I'm your host, Carbon.
I'm Emily.
I'm Lewis.
I'm Patrick.
And I'm Amanda.
And welcome to the show. And this episode is sponsored by Vizzy Hard Seltzer and Field, but more on that later.
If you're thinking about opening up your relationship or if you're in the early stages of exploring non-monogamy, this episode is a must watch to avoid jealousy, heartbreak, and miscommunication. In this episode, we're joined by three queer non-monogamous therapists to give you a roadmap on how to open up your relationship with care and intention, and how to navigate both relational and inner conflict along the way. Whether you're non-monogamy curious or already deep in the trenches, I'm sure this episode has something for you.
And today's guests are the three lovely humans behind the Polyamory Therapy Collective, a practice dedicated to providing affirming spaces for individuals, couples, and polycules navigating polyamory and consensual non-monogamy. They use integrative therapeutic modalities to help clients navigate complex emotions, resolve relational and internal conflicts, and build healthy connections.
Our first guest is Amanda Vandenbrock. Her pronouns, who is a registered psychotherapist qualifying, specializing in sex therapy with a focus on queer sexuality, open relationships, and menopause. Our second guest is Patrick Plessa, he, they pronouns, who is a registered psychotherapist also qualifying and holds a PhD in critical psychology. They specialize in existential psychotherapy for queer, polyamorous, and kink communities. And you'll also recognize Pat from our episode about the psychology of kink.
That wasn't me. That was an Amish fellow.
Right, with a very weird hat. Our final guest is Lewis Kay, he, him pronouns, who comes to his therapy practice with a background as a university lecturer, researcher, and media artist. He has a PhD in communication and cultural studies and has an interest in therapy for poly, kink, and queer individuals in relationships.
To start us off, can you give us a brief overview into what open relationship entails and what other forms of non-monogamy exist out there?
Yeah, there's such a spectrum of stuff, right? Like, you've probably heard the phrase monogamish, everything from like monogamous couples who maybe dabble once in a while, open relationships. There's all sorts of consensual non-monogamous stuff, solo poly, relationship anarchy, hierarchical poly, kitchen table poly, garden
swangers
party poly,
lap sitting poly.
What's a lap sitting?
What's that?
So many words.
Well, kitchen table, there's still a table between us.
Oh, I think lap sitting now they're is sitting like, on your lap.
Yeah, yeah. We're in it. We're the same person. How would we define, though, for our audience, like an actual just open relationship?
For me, it's open relationships are the way you're going to define it yourself. Mm-hmm. Defining it for other people is, I think, possibly part of the problem. So open is just consensual non-monogamy. You and your partner or partners consent having relationships with other people. How you negotiate that amongst yourselves, that's what really matters.
So you'd say it's more broad. I think like what I've seen, and I feel like what people think, is open relationship means kind of no feelings, like just like sex.
Sexual relationships.
Mainly sex.
I've recently encountered one partner in this partnership was like, I've caught feelings, and it was a revelation of, you know, I am so sorry, like a betrayal. Yeah. Like I stepped out of our agreement that this was going to be, you know, we have this open relationship, therefore we don't have feelings.
Right.
And I said to the person that I was closer to in that couple, like, oh no, oh no, 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 no. This is the real stuff. This is the, you know, you get feelings.
Do we think it's possible to sleep with someone and not catch feelings?
That was the question I was going to ask. Can you have sex without feelings?
I think it depends on the person, no?
Or the frequency,
I think frequency matters.
I think what Lewis is getting at is that feelings are not a detachable thing, so they happen regardless. It's just we're talking about intensity of feelings and, right, gradation. Because, like, you know, don't have sex without feeling anything. Mm. So it's not either or. It's just, like, how much.
Mm-hmm. And what kind? Yeah.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of people, myself included, when we first started, felt like it was safe to just start an open relationship because, there's no feelings. Like, we're just kind of, like, this is what's locked in, but everything else is just, like, we're just having fun, you know? What would you say to that? Is that a bad idea to go in with that mindset?
I think it's dangerous. Yeah. I think it's, you're probably going to be proven wrong quite quickly unless you have a rule. Some people have rules where it's only one encounter with one person. You can only have a one night stand.
I mean, you know, even with those kinds of rules, I've heard from like friends having that sort of like an arrangement where it's like you can one night stands only, but then maybe that person in that one night stand catches some sort of even small feeling, mm-hmm. and then it turns into a two-night stand, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and then it turns into lies because you agreed into one-night stand. So it is, I think, probably dangerous either way.
So when you think about rules and boundaries and stuff that you set with your partner, hopefully not for your partner, mm-hmm. in opening up relationships, what are the rules meant to protect, mm-hmm. right? And who? Because then you can start to realize that it might be protecting insecurities rather than mm-hmm. things mm-hmm. that are important to you, mm. right? And this is why the rules that are set out sometimes get broken quickly, mm-hmm. right? So it's just, it's about assessing why those rules.
Rules are also a really challenging word to use in this context because they have connotations of being very strict. Yeah. This is where like negotiation sometimes runs up against this idea of rules, right? If negotiations are fluid and flexible mm-hmm. and the communication is ongoing, mm-hmm. strict rules, I mean, guidelines might be a better word.
That is where you run into your partner feeling controlled and there being mm-hmm. tension between the two of you. I think after the experience that the two of us have had, I would never want to tell a partner what to do.
Right.
You know what I mean? If we're both mutually deciding that this is the way that we want to go about opening our relationship or exploring polyamory and like understanding that that can change on a regular basis mm-hmm. and it's always open for communication.
That's the important
that
part.
Is how I would go about things. Mm-hmm. In the future. What we just said can probably sound a little scary. Some people maybe just like clicked on this video. They're thinking, I'm interested in opening up my relationship. And maybe we just frightened them by saying that things can probably go wrong if there's control or...
Well, some things are going to go wrong. Yeah. Things always go wrong.
Probably. I think that's almost a really good way to go into it is just knowing like you're going to, can I swear on this?
Oh, yeah.
Fuck up. You are going to fuck up. Yeah. You're going to fuck up. Just be ready for that and have safeguards in place. Like when you set boundaries, that there should be kind of a almost agreed upon renegotiation schedule, like maybe a monthly check-in of like, how's this going? How did it go with that? But again, it takes so much internal processing to be poly, I think.
It's a little scary. There's definitely lots of good pieces about non-monogamy that are really exciting. There's a reason that people continue to do it. I'm wondering, how can someone tell if exploring non-monogamy, if opening up their relationship is right for them and their partner?
It was for me because I saw that my values were being represented there. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, this is like an ethical way to do the thing that I want to do and not mm-hmm. feel ashamed. I often think of polyamory as a system of ethics. Non-monogamy doesn't necessarily have that set of ethics.
Okay.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So like the broader like open scope of things is that you have this umbrella thing, which mm-hmm. doesn't necessarily have a set of ethics. I think polyamory does.
Okay.
If you happen to align with those values, like personal autonomy, sexual and romantic autonomy, I would say that that's kind of the knowing if it's for you or not. I often like to think about polyamory and non-monogamy to frame it around the most successful relationships that we have, which are friendships, mm-hmm. right? So I'm like, how can I do my romantic life like I do my mm-hmm. friendship life? Because if I can do that, then I know that my romantic life will be pretty good. You know, the monogamous past when it's like the romantic life was struggling and it was hard and there's all these things that come up. Mm. Yet in my friendships, they don't come up. And that's because there's certain liberties in friendships, right? You allow your friends to have other friends. Your friends allow you to have other friends. There's a sense in which you have the autonomy to make decisions for yourself. And you are often supported by the people who you choose to have in your life.
Can we go back to why you feel that non-monogamy doesn't have the same set or similar set of ethics as like polyamory?
I think it's just because it's a broader umbrella. And within non-monogamy, you have all sorts of open relationships. Things like, for example, swingers, there's rules and norms, perhaps more norms in swinger communities that are unlike polyamorous norms, right?
Mm-hmm. And so, for people listening, swinging is like swapping partners sexually, right? Yeah. Like group sex dynamics.
Yeah, you can have soft swap, hard swap mm-hmm. swingers. They often only play while they're together, but mm-hmm. sometimes apart as well. In polyamory, there's just been a sort of norm building mm-hmm. towards good communication skills mm-hmm. and again, values of autonomy, sexual and romantic relationships, as well as personal autonomy. And I would add to that a sense of radical honesty. In my experience in polyamory, it mm-hmm. seems like these are the norms that come up in this community mm-hmm. that I don't necessarily see in other non-monogamous spaces.
I actually, and Pat knows this. I don't really personally identify as polyamorous, simply because for me, the amory part is personally quite difficult. Love is something very precious. It's not something that is easily transferable. I agree with a lot of the ethics part of it. In some of my relationships, which have been defined more as consensually non-monogamous or open, the shared ethical values between me and my partner and partners have always been there too.
I'd actually also even like to add that I think that there are ethics to, say, like the swinger community as well. Like, it's not just that ethics only come in when you start talking poly or polyamory. They've discussed their ethics around what they feel is okay.
You could be a swinger and have the exact same set of ethics.
Totally.
But right. I think that these ethics, from the experiences I've had, originate from the polyamorous community, and they spread out. And I've seen monogamous folks pick up these same sets of ethics.
The interesting thing too, when we first started working with Field, is they were very strict about the language that we'd use about saying ethical non-monogamy. Anytime we'd say non-monogamy, they're like, no, like like they're very different, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that can also tie into what you're saying as well, as like many people are practicing ethical non-monogamy, but then there's like a debate about what is included in just non-monogamy.
That's also why a lot of the academic literature around this has shifted its language to consensual non-monogamy.
Right.
So in articles and research projects you see around this right now, the language and the acronym is CNM. Ethics opens up this whole space of debate and disagreement.
Yeah, now we're
debating.
Right. Yeah, we're fighting.
What the ethics are.
Yeah. So for folks who are starting out their non-monogamy journey, they're thinking about just opening up this relationship. And this, maybe this video is their first dipping their toes in. How do they go about making sure whatever they're deciding to do is ethical?
That goes back to Patrick's point, which will probably come up more and more in the conversation, which is radical honesty. You know, looking inwards, first of all, and being like, I don't personally feel whole if I'm in a single partnership where it's just two people. Mm-hmm. So I would like to have more of that in my life. Mm-hmm. How can I do that and be honest with everyone? And if you're honest with everyone, then the ethics will most likely follow in a nice way, because you're going to do stuff that everybody is happy with, that everybody feels comfortable with, and everybody agrees to, the consensual part.
It's a challenge. Like, if you're talking about an existing monogamous relationship and how to open that up, and it's one partner who's like, I'm thinking about this. How do you raise that with another partner without alienating them, without making them feel insecure? That's a real challenge. If I was going to suggest that an approach to somebody, it would be about asking about non-monogamy in general rather than going in and saying, this is something that I want to do, right? What do you think about it?
What's the success rate?
Oh my goodness, I wouldn't hazard a guess on that. I honestly can't say. I can give you just a personal anecdote around that. I did broach that with a partner at one point. Yeah. It was very not successful.
Okay.
Very not successful.
So far, zero in your experience.
my personal, so when I started doing sort of consensual non-monogamy, it was I entered into a relationship with somebody with the expectation from both sides that neither of us wanted to do monogamy.
Okay.
So
which I feel like is usually a good place to start.
Yeah. We were starting from a similar no monogamy, no more.
Yeah.
You got to ask yourself, what are your values? What are your desires? And not be afraid of the answer.
Oh, and another big question, why? Oh my goodness, why are you wanting this right now for yourself? What is it? Like, if you're in a relationship and that's what you're wanting, why are you asking yourself this? Is it coming from the right place?
You know what I mean? What would you say the wrong place is?
your relationship is in trouble.
Yeah.
Right.
It's the trying to save the relationship with polyamory, which is, it's common. It's one of the questions
What's the success rate of that?
I wouldn't know, but of the people that I know that have tried it, it's often not gone well. We have some insecurity in our relationship, emotional insecurity. Mm-hmm. So why don't we add some more?
let's make it even worse.
Right?
Yeah. True.
Let's turn our attention to other people to satisfy the things that we can't satisfy for each other right now. Yeah. And then hopefully our problem gets resolved.
It's going to be great.
Honestly, ever since that we started our opening up / polyamorous journey, immediately we told everybody. And so we shared it with a lot of friends and stuff. And then they got curious. And then they were like, we're having some issues in our relationship. I think I'm going to try what you tried. And then that's going to fix our problems. And we're like, don't do it. And then they're like,
danger ahead.
Too late.
They're like, we're going to do it. And I'm like, what did I say?
Also get a puppy and have a kid at the same time.
Exactly.
Oh, right.
Okay. I've seen that as well.
So things should we break going up well, or get a puppy?
Fern's book, Polysecure. I think she makes a pretty good distinction there between emotional security and structural security. If a relationship starts lacking emotional security, then people will try to panic and build structural security. Come move in with me. Let's have the dog. Let's have the kid. Because that's a way of building a sort of like fence around the relationship. You now live with me. We share finances. We have these things that are going to keep us together and prevent breaking apart. And that is not a great way to resolve the emotional insecurity in the relationship.
I don't know if this is too blunt, but I would say definitely figure out your relationship issues first. Go to therapy. See if you want that to work and make that work.
Our contact info will be in the show notes.
This podcast is proudly sponsored by Vizzy Hard Seltzer.
Over the last 5 years, Vizzy has supported our mission to authentically and positively represent the entire LGBTQ2S+ community.
And with Vizzy's vibrant flavors, you can follow your own vibe. Be bold, be flavorful, and above all else, be yourself. Plus, Vizzy only has 100 calories and 1 gram of sugar per can.
Cheers. Must be of legal drinking age and please enjoy responsibly.
And now back to the episode.
The next piece, which we already kind of tapped on, is like, how do you propose the idea of opening up your relationship to your long-term partner? What's our advice
Let's
here?
Let's assume that the structure is good.
The soft test, the, you know, you watch a show that has, that depicts non-monogamy ethically in it, and how what did you think of that? That's interesting. Maybe one of you's read an article and you're like, oh, I read this article. That might be a bit forward, but you know, something light. Or we heard that Jim and Sally are opening up and, you know, they seem to have a new vigor in their relationship. Have you noticed how they look at each other now? They seem to be excited.
The hard test would be like, hey, do you want to do this?
Yeah.
Lock in now.
What is this?
Starting tomorrow.
I mean, the thing with approaching it with your partner is it's a genie in the bottle thing. Once you ask, it's out. You can't just be like, no, it's cool. I wasn't thinking about it at all. Just forget that I said that. Once you ask it, it's been asked.
I'll share that little story. So
I was going to say, I was like, can we just go around and see how we all tested the waters?
When it didn't work with my partner at the time, they were like, oh, you want an open relationship, eh? Uh-huh. Really? Uh-huh. No. It was one of these situations where the relationship wasn't going well. The window slammed shut so hard, so fast. It was kind of more of an indication that the relationship wasn't going well.
Mine was like a soft hard test.
Right.
In one conversation, we went soft to hard. Many moons ago, I traveled abroad with my partner. And we sat at a bar drinking late into the night.
What was the land?
It was in Romania. Went there and we were drinking. There's a brochure sitting on the table, you know, like one of those city guides that tells you what's going on in the city. And if you flip to the back pages, right, you find back page material. And there was something offering like erotic massage. I soft opened with, hey, I wonder if they do couples massages and like, would you be... Is that something exciting? And she was interested. We kept talking about it and flirting with it. And we're like, what would it look like? What would it mean? How would this be? And it went from that to making the phone call and having an erotic massage as a couple. And it went really well. And
there
it was lovely. And then
positive story.
Yeah. And then we came back to Toronto and we're like, okay, we obviously enjoyed this. Where do we go from here? And the next stop was Oasis.
You move fast.
The door opened.
Opened wide.
And then you gave it a push.
It was very like back and forth. So it was really nice that it was, you know, mutual.
I opened up solo. So I didn't have a partner to broach it with. That doesn't mean I didn't do a lot of things incorrectly at the beginning, like not really being out on my dating profiles and maybe not telling everyone right away that this was my relationship style. So yeah, but I didn't have to have a conversation with one individual saying, what do you think about this? It was more me coming into it and then being very forward with it right off the bat.
For us, I think one thing that you said, Amanda, really resonated is once you open the door, you can't really close it. Like it's genie in the bottle. I remember listening to the podcast Curious Fox. I'm not sure if any of you had listened to it. It's great. But she mentions that the thing is, the person who's proposing it is usually you've been thinking about this mm-hmm. for a while and you're excited about the idea. And a lot of the time we have this like notion in our mind that the other person is going to be as excited as we are because we're so jazzed about this. So you'll bring it up to your partner and they may have never thought about this before. And that's going to like shock them and like rock their world. And they won't be able to see the relationship in the same way ever again, perhaps mm-hmm. for them, depending mm-hmm. on like their perspective of the relationship. It is an important moment. And I would say those soft openings are very important. For us, I was the overeager person for sure. Like I was really excited. We had just had a conversation with Yaz about polyamory and I was like, wow, what do you think? Yeah. So exciting. Should we do it? And you were panicked.
Panicked so much. Yeah. I was like, what? Like, I thought we were just having a conversation. Mm-hmm. Being curious about it in the way that you're curious about like someone's religion without wanting to take part in it or something right. like that. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah. I can't give it like
a good example.
I'm not ready That's to fair. Convert. That's crazy. But then yeah. it was that thing where like as soon as it was mentioned, my perception of the relationship changed. Mm. And I was like, okay, this feeling, this desire, even if I say no right now and we don't do that for a while, will continue to exist. And mm-hmm. it'll probably come back up at some point. From there on, from that moment of having that conversation, I was like, okay, things are going to change, like, mm-hmm. regardless, at some point, whether it's delayed, or it's now, or it's 6 months, or it's mm-hmm. in a few years, like, it's going to happen. It took me a long time to, I guess, open myself up to the idea, but, like, I knew mm-hmm. that I had to work towards it.
If the conversation hadn't come up,
I would have never thought about it.
You would have never thought about it.
I would have never thought about it.
It wouldn't have come into your... Nope. Yeah, interesting. Right? Yeah. Monogamy is such a pervasive paradigm in society that it's what we were talking last night. It's like if you asked a fish to explain water, they're like, mm-hmm. I don't... What's water? Mm-hmm. Because you're just in it.
And I think the tough thing that did come up for you was this feeling like, oh, if you want this, that means I'm not enough. Or mm-hmm. our relationship isn't enough, which is, true. I guess, like this, yeah, which is a totally
which
true
is
fact.
100% facts. It's not enough. Thank you, Pat.
I mean, very helpful. Yeah,
I'm not joking. I don't think any one relationship can ever be enough. Yes. Right? Like, again, that's part of the sort of ethics of polyamory. It's just like mm-hmm. this notion that monogamy. Got that one wrong.
Yeah.
Just to assume that one person needs to satisfy everything mm-hmm. yeah. for you, your one romantic partner, is nuts.
It is.
Yeah.
There's no other relationship in your life that you put mm-hmm. that much pressure on. Mm-hmm. And it's fine if you want to be monogamous, mm-hmm. But reassess those expectations.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it was more the concern of like not being enough for you sexually, I guess. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I think plenty mm-hmm. of people do have one long-term partner for the majority of their lives. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cheating that goes on.
For sure.
Statistically.
Statistically,
it isn't often enough.
Yeah.
And I admire the people for whom it is. I'm like, mm-hmm. that's mm-hmm. amazing.
Yeah.
That you're mm-hmm. sexually satisfied with one partner for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. It seems simple. In a way that is admirable. I'm like, I sometimes wish I could do that.
I sometimes wish I could do that.
Just say, you know, it would make things easier. Now I don't have to think so hard about this other thing. Yeah. And I can focus on
You just follow the
else.
Rules that are made up for you, which can be really relaxing.
Right?
It's
safe.
It takes so much of the stress out of life.
That is what it comes down to a lot of times. It's like, but I was given a script and I'm following the script and that's really nice. Like I'm supposed to hit all these markers.
Well, this is the existentialist coming out, but like existentially speaking, freedom is one of the most terrifying things mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. then we have to decide and making a choice about every single thing and taking the responsibility of the consequences of that choice is existentially terrifying. Mm-hmm. So many of us like to live in that bad faith.
Just deciding what I want for dinner is kind of a lot.
We want decisions to be made for us so that life is easier.
So according to an article by Field titled Cheating in Open Relationships, Is It Even Possible? It's important to set up clearly communicated boundaries before entering the relationship. Otherwise, we open the door for potential gray areas to emerge, which can lead to deceit. What are the important things a couple should discuss to get clear on before opening up their relationship?
Well, first, the answer to that question, is it even possible? Yes.
It's almost about the minutiae of what you're going to be okay with at the beginning. Okay, so we're going to open up. Like, are you okay if I go on a dating app? Are you okay if I present in a certain way on the dating app? Are you going to open up and it's a free for all and you think you're at the buffet and suddenly your partner is out 6 nights a week with different people and you're at home being like, what? You know, what are you okay with how often they're out or you're out? The communication with other partners, like maybe they've got another partner who wants consistent texting throughout the whole day and you're like, I hate seeing you on your phone all the time. What information you're comfortable with your partner sharing to other partners about your relationship, about you. It's so minute. You get into like, you know, and you don't even think about it because again, it's like the fish in the water. It's like if you're in a monogamous relationship and you've established your communication styles and your whatever, you don't think of those things as stuff that you actually did set out. You know, you set out, if you're not living together, you set out kind of a frequency of, you know, do we see each other once a week? Do we see each other twice a week? But you've set that out. So you actually need to kind of look at that with every partnership. Like, okay, are we okay with, you know, I've got partners that I see once a month. It's not hard for the other partners because it's really not taking a whole lot of time away from my schedule. But if I started seeing someone and they're like, I'd like to see you twice a week, that would be really hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a big shift in your day-to-day life is suddenly now your partner is unavailable 2 days of the week and you're used to seeing them maybe all the time. The biggest thing I would say is start very slow. Mm-hmm. Communicate things, dip your toe in, and check in.
Yeah, and start like, with this, like, who's kind of at the slowest pace? Like, I'm assuming when you two started, you might have been at the slower pace thinking, like, I still need to process that this is going to be happening. Ease into it at their pace.
Yeah, I think that's really good advice. It's the same as hiking. You're never going to run ahead the slowest person.
Something that I heard talked about was, like, dating yourself. As well, primarily because when you date yourself, you give yourself a lot of that time. Then when you find yourself in one relationship, you're only giving them some of that time and you're still giving yourself a lot of that time. So to add another partner, they don't have all the time to begin with. Like that first partner doesn't have all that time to begin with. You're still giving yourself a lot of it rather than like, here's all of it. Now I'm going to take away from you.
Yeah. So it doesn't feel like they're losing something in the process. Like you're taking it away from your time.
Yeah.
Rather than taking away from like the time that would have been spent in your couple before.
Well, I like to answer this question more idealistically.
Sure.
This begins with radical honesty with the self first. A lot of this where there's like mistakes being made is when people worry too much about their partner's behavior. Right? Rather than, let's say, having a conversation where hopefully you have the vulnerability and the trust in your relationship to be radically honest and say, here's what I want. Let's hear what you want. And let's see if there's compatibility between those things. And there might not be. And that could be hard. But it's being able to be secure enough to like state your desires and then hopefully have your partner support them despite how they feel about it. In a practical sense, to translate this for me, and I think everybody here is familiar with this notion that boundaries are things that you set for yourself and your body, not for somebody else. Rather than negotiating with a partner, like, here's what I'm comfortable with you doing. Already, I think that the way that that conversation has started for me is...
controlling.
Yeah, it's not great. I really understand that for people just starting this, going the idealistic route that I'm proposing is next to impossible.
Because it's an intense mind shift.
You want to feel secure and you're like, I can't just jump in. But I've always thought about like, where do I want to be, right? Yeah. Like, what does my ideal relationship look like? And if I set that out as my goal, then I can start building the practical steps to get there, which may be incremental. I might not want my partner to have unprotected sex with anybody else as a matter of safety, as a matter of whatever, right? But I wouldn't set it as a boundary for them. I wouldn't say, so you're not allowed to have sex, unprotected sex with somebody else. I would just say, if you happen to have unprotected sex with somebody else, intentionally or accidentally, I would really appreciate it if you let me know, and then I'll reassess my boundaries around that. It's not laying out consequences for them. It's just saying, you know, I can't control what you do. I can only control my reaction to what you do.
You know, from a practical standpoint, when things get a little tricky, I actually started to adopt language from kink relationships using safe words.
Yeah.
For instance, in emotional conversations. So my partner and I, we had a phrase we would call like emotional safe word. That was the phrase, right? When things got really heated, we would say emotional safe word, and then we developed a strategy that we were able to, okay, when we started fighting over, I don't want this, I don't want you to do that.
Yeah.
And this took us down and got us back to a place where we could have an actual conversation rather than a fight.
My parents had that too. Their emotional safe word was fuck you.
It's really good.
They usually ended things.
Yeah. It stops right away.
Yeah.
That's how their arguments always ended.
I want to also make the point though, when you do have those moments where you've something is built up in you and you're feeling stressed and, oh my goodness, this is really bugging me and I'm feeling all these feelings about myself, like maybe I'm not doing this right and maybe I'm not cut out for this and blah, blah, blah. And then you have a conversation with your partner about whatever is going on and then you feel really good afterwards and you have like this feeling of like, I grew today.
What if you don't feel really good after? For example, we have a question from an audience member and they said, I have no interest in controlling my girlfriend or telling her what she can do with her body, etc. The problem is I constantly find myself immediately and immensely nauseous, repulsed, emotional, reactionary, angry, judgmental, jealous, envious, begging for more attention and feeling abandoned, rejected, ignored, and like she doesn't care. They really like laid it out for us. Mm-hmm. I'm so upset that every time she brings up a person, I feel that way no matter what. I wish I could be chill, but I'm constantly sobbing and making comments that make her feel like she's doing something wrong, which I hate even more. What's going on and what should you do in this situation?
Can I tackle this one?
Please.
Can I just say that's a lot. All of that is completely meaningful. So just the first thing is validate.
It probably resonates with a lot of people that are listening.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to say I went through that personally. Primal panic, I don't know if we've heard this, is like this very intense fear of abandonment that just triggered all of these emotions that if you're thinking about it rationally, like everything that's happening is agreed upon. I consented to this. I shouldn't be feeling this way. I've got my affirmations, but I'm having all of these really visceral reactions.
Sounds like insecurity, right? And it's something that they need to take responsibility for. And again, I think they know this. Your partner isn't doing this to you, right? This is just something that you're experiencing. Like it could be any partner, your future partner. Like you'd probably experience the same sorts of feelings, right? For me, I would suggest thinking about what the source of that insecurity is. What are the feelings related to? Do they come up from something from childhood? Do they come up from like past relationships? Right. Think of the feelings, what they're associated with. What do you see when you close your eyes and you think about what's happening with your partner? And then turn those mental images and those feelings into a statement about yourself. Once you can turn it into a statement about yourself, right, and you can hear it, then I would say find some compassion for yourself. Find that inner empathy for that statement. And then if you could be vulnerable with your partner, ask for support. And then I think therapy.
That's really where like a therapist would come in, is working with you to think about, you know, ask the questions that are going to prompt you to look at each of the feelings and figure out where they come from, because they're probably going to come from, you know, childhood stuff that happened, you know, bullying or maybe insecure attachment stuff with parents. And when you look back at those and you say, oh, like these patterns saved me in the past, like this kept me safe, and now they don't.
Honor your coping mechanisms because they help you cope, right? They help you get through the hard stuff. That doesn't mean you have to hold on to them.
A way that I heard it being talked about in terms of coping mechanisms that no longer work for you is to try to assign them a new task.
Absolutely.
If we like personify it.
Yep.
And your task is to be repulsed and jealous and angry and emotional and all these things. Can we assign it a new task?
Internal family systems, yes.
I had a little bit of internal family systems therapy.
And wonderful.
It actually really did help with redirecting my reactions, and also allowed me to give myself some compassion for what I was feeling instead of just being angry at myself for feeling certain ways.
That's a big part.
How do you deal with the imposter syndrome that can come up when maybe you're the one who's not doing so well and you're looking over at your partner and you're like, why aren't you losing it? How are you okay right now? And I'm like, so not okay.
I've heard this be weaponized against people, like, well, maybe you're not good at poly, maybe this isn't for you. And it's you know, it can be said down the nose, you know, like, which I think is weaponized on both sides. Like, you just need to not be jealous. You need to not have these feelings. But I don't know anybody who hasn't, you know? And so it's the internal looking. What is this bringing up? What is this echoing from my past life that is resonating really hard right now? Because poly will bring everything you've buried up, I think.
Yeah, it's really good at that.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, because you're in
your specialty.
Yeah. Like, to be good at poly is not, I don't know, it's like yoga. You're never perfect at yoga. It's like it's always a practice.
And the other thing about imposter syndrome is it kind of traces its roots back to self-doubt, right? And that's a good thing. I like to think of self-doubt as a very honest way of looking at the world, right? Of looking at oneself.
It's humility.
Yeah. We all have doubt. We all don't know what's like, am I doing the right thing? Those are really good questions to ask ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. What's the opposite of that is like a sociopath, basically, who thinks they're always right all the time. Mm-hmm. So everybody I know experiences some kind of self-doubt.
How many of you have felt imposter syndrome around polyamory? Yeah.
All of us. For those listening, every hand up.
When I ask students if they've ever felt imposter syndrome, again, majority of hands are up. I think that the issue is that we assume that the most confident people that we see out there don't feel it, but that's because we don't have access to their inner world. And if we did, I'm sure we'd find that they do have a sense of imposter syndrome. And again, the ones who don't are fucking scary.
The way that we show our lives online and the way that we consume a lot of like influencers' lives, a lot of like non-monogamous influencers' lives is you're getting the best bits of somebody. You're getting the most educated, polished points of someone's life. That can give you this perception that that is how they feel 100% of the time. And because you're getting a lot of your information from them and you're seeing them as this aspirational person, you're like, oh, I really would like to experience your life. It can make you feel like, oof, it looks really gross the way I'm doing it. It's a really big mess over here, but they look like they're killing it. It can make you feel like this huge imposter. But I think also we can see it as you can also get that in so many other aspects in your life too.
Yeah, that's like, why I've gone on a diet. I don't consume influencers anymore.
Gone on a diet.
Just like, I had to cut that out of my diet. It was
good.
Getting,
like podcasts are actually like the saving grace for me because people get so real on podcasts. Right. Like people will actually tell their real full story. And like we were saying, the Curious Fox podcast, it was a lot of like very honest discussions. We try to be as honest as possible on our podcast too about the ways that we fuck up. Because honestly, we're talking to our friends and they're having the exact same experiences. Like no one's doing this very well.
What about monogamous folks? Who asks them if they fuck up? Do they question themselves?
They fuck up a lot too.
I don't know how many successful monogamous relationships I can cite that I've seen work out. And again, this is like from an outsider's perspective, I don't see their inner lives, right? Mm-hmm. So do people question themselves about fucking up monogamy?
Well, what's the divorce rate?
Yeah.
I think it's like upwards of
50%. I think people are also very hard on themselves about that, about feeling like I had a failed relationship. You know what I mean? Like seeing in that perspective, I think all of us see life in a very, like many of us can see it in a very black and white perspective.
I just haven't heard somebody say like, am I doing monogamy right?
Right. Yeah. True. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. This is a good point.
But to your point too, like people think in monogamy, it's like it's only successful if one of you dies.
So we should kill each
and
other.
And I get the insurance. Money. Yeah.
That was 0 to 100.
Yeah,
that was soft hearted.
So on that note though, what are some signs that maybe it's not for you? Or do you believe that it's for everyone?
No. Okay. Nothing is for everybody.
That's interesting.
Right? Right? Everybody has a preference. And monogamy is a perfectly legitimate and meaningful choice for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Like if that's what works for them, that's what resonates for them culturally, spiritually, emotionally.
Time-wise.
Temporally. Mm-hmm. Then do that, mm-hmm. right? Then that's your choice. You just own your choice, right? I've had those doubts too. Mm. I don't know. But then I try to go back and think, could I do monogamy again? And the answer to that is invariably, for me personally, the answer to that is no. I can't do it.
The genie in the bottle thing, even if it's tough, it's very hard to shove it back in to the bottle. You know,
because as you said, monogamy is only successful when one of you dies. I was like, wow, that's
hardcore.
But I also look at it the other way, which is what that means is that monogamy requires complete self-sacrifice, right? You sacrifice everything up to your life for it to be successful. So the question is that what you want? And if that is a yes, then sounds like monogamy is for you. And for me, that's a fuck no. So
fuck no.
One of my strongest values is personal autonomy.
Yeah.
Right? Is freedom. And that's what polyamory means to me.
To kind of recap it for people, the question was, how do you know if you're not set out for monogamy or if you shouldn't be doing it, and bouncing off of imposter syndrome as well. And I think first, number one, I think if you align with the values of it, if you're willing to work on yourself to get there, then it's for you.
And if you have the time.
If you have the time to do it.
I mean,
do you agree with that as kind of like a basis?
The time is a practical question, right? Like, and poly does take time, but I think you can still be fully invested in this as a way of living and not have a lot of time.
Yeah.
Right? It because that changes over time, so to speak. But you also have to be careful of that because saturation is a possibility.
Saturation is real.
Right?
Real.
Saturation is real. Right.
And what does saturation mean?
Polysaturation.
You take on too many partners for the amount of time or emotional bandwidth that you have.
Yeah. And everyone has a different degree.
Everyone has a different threshold. Yeah. Everyone has more to give. Different people have different amounts of time, energy, space, finances.
Yeah. And
poly can get kind of expensive.
Because you're paying for a lot of dates.
You're paying for a lot of dates. Yeah.
If you're watching this episode and you're thinking open relationships do sound like the thing for me, but I just don't know where to start. Where do I go? How do I meet people? Where do I put my hands? I know exactly where you should put your hands. And it's on the dating app Field. That's actually where the two of us started exploring when we just opened up our relationship.
The dating landscape is riddled with alienating behaviors like mindless swiping and ghosting. It may seem inconceivable that anything else out there exists, but it does. You have options. Field, the dating app for the curious, is a space where open-minded people come to playfully explore each other and themselves. In the same way that entering a different room can bring out a different side of yourself, stepping onto Field may reveal new parts of yourself that you haven't met before. There's breathing room to explore your desires, think relationship anarchy, cuddling, being a brat. And find communities that share your interests, think D&D, tennis, zine making. Free from ads and completely independent, this is the space that draws curious, playful, open-minded people such as yourself. In connecting more deeply to yourself, it's possible to find your people and build the community that you've been looking for. Here's a little preview of what life is like on Field.
I used to think I was too femme to be dominant, too feminine to be anything but a woman, and too boxed in by labels that I never chose. But then I got on Field. Exploring ethical non-monogamy and kink there cracked something open in me, and I started playing with dominance and stepping into a side of myself that I'd always kept at an arm's length. By the end of the year, my gender and sexuality had shifted in ways I never saw coming, and I'm not the only one. 62% of Field members evolved their desires, identities, and interests within their first year on the app. When you're in a space with no expectations, no boxes to squeeze into, you get to see what's actually yours.
So get out your phone right now, go to the App Store or Google Play and download Field. That's spelled F-E-E-L-D. Thank you, Field, for sponsoring this episode.
Lewis, a question for you. When things went wrong for you when you initially proposed it to that partner, did you ever feel like regret in bringing it up?
I have regrets about the way I engaged in doing that conversation and some of the activities I was doing that led up to them, which were, to be perfectly transparent, non-consensual non-monogamy, right? I was cheating. It was a really good learning experience. I did wrong, and I resolved to not do that again. In the long run, it worked. In the long run, it helped get me where I needed to go.
Yeah.
In the short run, I regret the fact that it hurt my partner.
If you're in a dynamic where maybe it's not headed in a bad place, but you've made mistakes and hurt each other along this process of like opening things up, as like all of us have claimed that we've done, like we've all made mistakes, we're human. How do you deal with like guilt and regret?
Forgiveness, you know, ultimately in the long run, forgiveness, forgiving oneself for fucking up, right? I mean, it's, we're all going to do it. We don't want to intentionally hurt our partners. We really don't want to do that. If we are intentionally hurting somebody in a relationship, then you got some shit to work out.
I mean, speaking about hurting each other, what are the biggest mistakes that a lot of people make when they're first opening up their relationship? What are the best ways that we hurt each other?
They forget to keep putting the effort into their core relationship, right? Like it becomes so easy to like start throwing all your energy outside and you forget to keep building the core one.
If you're not coming at it with a partner already in place, like maybe you're coming at it solo, a common mistake is like, I'm at the buffet and I'm going to eat all the things at the buffet. And you're like, okay, you know, you just one small plate at a time. Like don't, again, that gets into the polysaturation zone. But yeah, it can be very exciting when you're like, I've got all these options. And it's like, okay, you only have so much time. You only have so much bandwidth. If you're just trying to throw up numbers, as someone once said to me.
Okay.
Then, you know, you're probably going to hurt people along the way and you're going to hurt yourself.
And I'd say the faster and more excited you're moving, the more likely you are to bulldoze over these feelings and make more mistakes. So that's why it's so good to go slow. And like it exasperates the mistake.
Yeah, you don't want to use that tech bro language, move fast and break shit.
Move fast and eat ass. No.
That's the one.
Transferable skills. Do we have any other ways that people can make mistakes and your suggestions on how they can do better?
Yes.
Hit us, Pat.
When you apply this sort of like monogamous framework to a new relationship, you follow the trajectory of the sort of like relationship escalator in monogamy. Mm-hmm. You start a relationship with a new partner, mm-hmm. new relationship energy is exciting, and there's lots of lust, and you incubate with that partner. You spend more time with it. You spend more time with this relationship and less time, like Lewis was saying, attending to your core relationship, you called it.
Yeah.
I think that it does follow that pattern of monogamy, of, you know, the relationship escalator, mm-hmm. right? The incubation period. And in this situation, it's very hard for your existing relationships not to fall apart, right? Because you can't match new relationship energy with like an old burn. They're not comparable.
I think especially when you've been in this relationship for a long time, you forget how intoxicating new relationship energy is. Mm-hmm. I think with an older relationship, it's very comfortable and like you're not used to, you don't normally, before you opened your relationship, you weren't going on all of these like fancy, exciting dates. Like you're happy to like watch a movie on the couch. Now you're having to introduce these new things because you're like, oh, why is that partner getting all of these nice, exciting things? Mm-hmm. That's what I want too. And I think one thing in our last episode with Decolonizing Love is they were saying is like, one, there is benefits to an older relationship, like the comfort, absolutely. The knowledge of each other, the understanding. It's remembering that, and that the new partner is also has some feelings of like envy towards that as well. And like there can be this feeling of like always wanting the thing that you don't have and thinking that the grass is greener. So I think it is appreciating what you have, but remembering to feed into those relationships so that they don't get lost, because you can get so intoxicated with new relationship energy. It's like a drug.
I have one more. Yeah, it's trying to live up to a particular ideal of what you think poly should be.
I think I did that the most.
Yeah? How so?
I had this idea of like what it should be. And I was like, if we're not meeting that, then we're failing or like, we're not doing that right.
Idealized visions are always, they're unrealistic. That's what makes them idealized, right? And we might want to work towards some model of that, but they're not ideal. Ideals aren't achievable by definition.
Mm-hmm. We talked a bit about how to manage and sort of forgive yourself when you fuck up. But how do you forgive the other person when they fuck up, say that they really hurt you badly?
One of the biggest mistakes is being dishonest with your partner. Like you said, like one of the biggest things is radical honesty about it. So it's like being in a non-monogamous relationship with someone is like, it's built on so much trust and so much honesty. And when you break that, it is very hard to move forward.
I think what makes sense for me is my understanding of my path to forgiveness is finding empathy for the other person. It's like, why did they do this thing? Why did they make this mistake? In the absence of being able to understand them, their intentions, and why this happened, it makes it hard to forgive, because then you're trying to get to closure without doing the work. If it's a situation where your lines of communication are open and you can have honest conversations, then that's the work that needs to be done, is to talk to the person who hurt you and understand it. Because then I think, at least for me, it enables the possibility to forgive in an honest way, not just in a way where I'm trying to like help myself get over the thing.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think how I've like been able to forgive your parents for like the things that they've done to you as a child and those kind of things. How do you forgive yourself? It's like all of it begins with empathy.
I know I'm going to fuck up. I know I'm going to hurt somebody. How would I want somebody else who cares about me to deal with that?
Most of the time, you'd like someone to be able to give you the chance to right your wrongs, you know, for both of us who like feel the guilt of that. And like, you want to be able to just do better. So I think if someone wants the opportunity to do better and you believe them that they're actually going to do better, because that's its own thing. It's like, you also want to have your own boundaries, but you'd want to be able to like have a second chance. And I do believe that people can be better.
If somebody hurts you, and even if the dynamic of the relationship changes, you're still able to forgive somebody and be on a good standing with them, mm-hmm. even if it's not how it was before.
And holding on to it only hurts you, honestly. Mm-hmm. It burdens you. It like ruins your thoughts. It makes everything so negative and heavy mm-hmm. and hard. Like the freedom that you will feel if you actually just let go of it and forgive people, whew, it's so much lighter.
Yeah. Yeah. It's also an act of empathy for yourself, mm-hmm. right? Forgiveness. And I think it should be stated also that if you do forgive somebody, that doesn't mean you have to continue a relationship of any kind with mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. You could let go completely. Mm-hmm. And that might be the way to let go in a very graceful way for both of you.
Yeah. And I think that is also honoring your own boundaries and standards as well. And that's totally fair. And I mm-hmm. respect that. Yeah. I'm trying to get better at that.
Honoring your own needs, I think, is also a hard thing in poly in general. Is like, mm-hmm. you can, or some people, maybe you probably feel this, I feel this, is mm-hmm. where it's like, oh, I don't want to have needs. Yeah. I don't want to have I just want to be really easygoing and like fun and like someone, you know, and then it's like, no, I'm actually not fun at all.
That's like saying, you know, I don't want anything.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't have
boundaries.
Yeah, it's like, no, I don't have wants. And that sometimes comes from a place of constant disappointment, right? Mm-hmm. So we just give up on wanting things because we know we're not going to get them.
Let's talk about couples privilege, which according to Field refers to the advantages, benefits, and accommodations that couples are automatically given in society over single people or non-nested partners. Do you have to dismantle couples privilege in order to be successful at non-monogamy?
No.
No.
No?
No.
Really? Okay, elaborate. That's not what I was expecting from you. So elaborate, please.
You know, couples privilege can manifest badly mm-hmm. in open relationships, yeah. right? Like the classic tale of the unicorn hunting couple that treats the third person like an object. That can be a form of couples privilege that is really unhealthy and kind of toxic. That being said, you can do hierarchical poly, and that's perfectly okay. You can have a core relationship that is a couple. And as long as you're not treating, you know, your metamours badly. It doesn't even have to be kitchen table. It doesn't have to be garden party. You know,
or lap sitting.
Yeah. As long as you're treating everybody with respect and care and everybody's kind of clear about what expectations are, sure, start with a couple. And also a personal anecdote with a partner at the time, we were thinking about dating a third, bringing a third to actually date together.
Yeah.
We met up with someone and they identified as a relationship anarchist. Mm. And they started going on about couples privilege. And I kind of understood it. But then
how they didn't like the couples privilege that you two had.
But we had been together for like 3 years already.
Yeah.
We had built a level of trust and intimacy and familiarity.
Yeah.
That there's no way somebody who's we're going to start dating is going to come in and have that with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Or at least not immediately.
Right. And so to come in right away and start demanding that they be treated equally felt a little like they weren't caring about us.
I think intimacy is earned as well. You know, like you're not going to give someone that you just met the same level of intimacy of an 8-year partner who knows your whole backstory.
Yeah. I feel like that's the first time that I've heard somebody say that hierarchy is perfectly fine.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting that.
Are you an anarchist?
I am. And I'm actually, I don't think relationship anarchy is radical enough.
Okay.
But that being said, I think there's three things here. My answer was also no. I don't think you need to dismantle couples privilege in order to
be successful.
If consent is had, then I might want to be in a relationship with somebody who is in a nested sort of like hierarchical thing, and I don't want to be as invested in that relationship.
Yeah, I want to be peripheral.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want it to be emotional. Right. I want it to be sexual, but
true.
You know, I do want to be on the outskirts. I don't want to be as invested in this person's life. I don't want to live with them.
If I consent
to that and they consent to that and we have a mutual understanding of that and we can renegotiate those needs as they happen, then I think that's perfectly fine. Couples privilege in terms of the sort of social structural things. Yeah, I think it's important to dismantle, but it's not like this needs to happen before we can get to this other thing. Right. So, yeah, it sucks that we live in a society where we can't extend our insurance benefits to partners outside of a primary of a single person. Right. So there are structural things which I think demand revising. And then when we get to hierarchical polyamory, I know this is a huge contentious issue in the in the community. There's like, you know, people who are anti-hierarchy and then there's people who are pro-hierarchy. And I think that at least in the arguments that I've seen, and I know that decolonizing polyamory, there's an assumption that is made, or at least that they make, which is that with hierarchical polyamory, you get veto power.
Yeah.
And right. I don't know where that came from, because I don't think it comes with hierarchical polyamory. I think it often does, but it's not a necessary feature of hierarchical polyamory. Why would it be? I think you can have hierarchical polyamory without veto power, in which case it can help structure certain relationships, like when somebody has an existing family, an existing, you know, children, mortgage, all sorts of things, right? It could be helpful so long as the consent is happening with all parties involved.
Yeah.
Having said that, I don't care for hierarchical polyamory. I want more radical relationship anarchy, which for me means creating no distinction between friends and partners. Mm-hmm. I want to treat everybody like they're my partners, right?
I want to pop everyone's pussy.
I just mean I'm going to have partners. I want to have friends that that are platonic. I want to have friends that are romantic. I want to have friends that I have sexual relationships with. And I want that to be able to fluctuate and have nothing have to end because our needs have changed. Wow. Right. And this for me is what I'm looking for. The hard part of this is that I'd have to find other people who are willing to practice this. And the only other person I've ever heard speak of this in the same way that I think about it was Alok. Mm. Alok in so many interviews was talking about friendship in this way. And I was like, yes. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I've been talking about this and to hear it from somebody else, also somebody who I admire, I think it was really nice.
So we're trying to get in contact with Alok, basically.
We started out as like a romantic relationship.
Kind of, yeah.
Well, and
the plot thickens.
And we've nicely transitioned into a lovely friendship, which I fully think is going to be for the rest of my life.
Absolutely.
Well, and now we've made the relationship professional,
professional
too.
Professional too. Oh my God, now professional.
But yeah, we know that goes really well. Yeah. But,
this is why I sat in the middle, just to cut the tension.
On that note, any advice for maintaining contact and staying friends with an ex? Because I guess that's, I mean, the circles are small.
Yaz and I dated for 5 years, polyamorous relationship anarchy, and our relationship changed last year. And I say changed, I've used the word transitioned. I don't like decoupling as much, but you know, all of these are describing the same event, which is we went from being romantic partners who lived together to no longer living together and no longer being romantic or having a sexual relationship. But we are friends. We still love each other very much and we're very much in each other's lives. So it's the same sort of thing. It's like the relationship didn't end. It continued in a new way that accommodated for our changing needs over time. And this is probably the thing that I love most about polyamory. In the past, when I was monogamous, every relationship that ended felt destructive. And there was some part of it that could not be recuperated. And these people that I spent years investing in are now out of my life. And that piece of me is gone with them, right? So it felt emptying. It felt harrowing. And now, ever since I've been polyamorous, from the very first relationship I had, we transitioned into a friendship. And that person is still in my life today and one of my best friends. And same with Yaz, still in my life, one of my best friends. I love both of them very much. We tell each other we love each other all the time. And again, I don't envision having a future without them in it.
I want to say that it takes a lot of maturity to be able to do that. Not everyone can do that. I don't know. It's this feeling of like seeing that person's life move forward without you so deeply in it. How do you be like comfort yourself with that while still like seeing
it's
them?
It's going to be painful no matter what. Yeah. But that's this is literally the least painful option, I think.
Do you
that's
think?
Also where compersion, for me. It's where compersion comes in.
Do you want to define compersion?
Compersion is just feeling, taking joy and pleasure from someone you care about. And their joy, their pleasure, their happiness is what gives me happiness. Why would I not be happy for someone I care about their happiness, right? It that logically just doesn't make sense to me.
But that's not the standard though, especially in a lot of monogamous relationships. I think the standard is like, unless I'm the person making you happy, then I'm not
happy
for
you.
Then it's like happiness becomes a zero sum game. You become happy outside of it, that takes away from my happiness. Whereas, you know, compersion is kind of like a positive sum game. Right? The happier you get, the happier I get.
Not everybody feels compersion though. Like it's not always something that people can access.
And I had some jealousies in there. I had some like moments where I'm like seeing them do things. And I'm like, mm-hmm. I wish that was me. But it's like, try to deal with that stuff.
Instead of working on undoing jealousy, mm-hmm. because jealousy, I think, it's a feeling. It comes up and it's going to come up. Mm-hmm. And I'm not trying to replace jealousy. Mm-hmm. But I am trying to work towards something that I really want,
yeah.
which is I want to feel joy for my partner. Yeah. So mm-hmm. I was, every time that I felt jealous, I was like, but wait, who am I trying to be in this moment, yeah. right? I don't want to be this person who's, you know, suffering and feeling these icky feelings. So mm-hmm. I'll feel them, I'll acknowledge them. And then how do I think about this in a way where I can experience joy for my partner right now?
Yeah. But like, what if that's not good for your mental health? Like, what if it's painful for you to, like, you're still not over the relationship? You know what I'm saying? I think a lot of the breakup advice that I hear from, like, relationship experts is, like, rid your house of any sign of this person, like, allow yourself to, like, move on. And, like, when you see them and you still have emotions and feelings for this person, it feels like you're reopening a wound. So how do you be friends with someone and transition them in your mind from, like, romantic to friendship without it hurting?
I don't think that that advice is wrong. Mm-hmm. I think even for Yaz and I, we took, I think, maybe a month mm-hmm. of no contact to just kind of settle into ourselves, see where we are and like, spend mm-hmm. time with ourselves and then come back and slowly rebuild what this friendship looks like, right? Because yeah. you do need a little break. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think at that point, you can come back and be less hot with the feelings of everything. And maybe you don't want to see them online. Maybe you don't want to know anything about their new relationship, because mm-hmm. it will fucking hurt you. If you need to take that space, take mm-hmm. the space, and then maybe agree to come back at a specific date, which is exactly what we did.
One of the important little details, though, in there too, is the, like, the social media aspect. Like, you don't need to see, you don't need to punish yourself by watching mm-hmm. your ex's life mm-hmm. unfold in the perfectly curated way it does unfold on social media. That break could be forever. Mm-hmm. Like, the social media break, I mean. Like, you could just say, hey, we're going to be friends in real life. We're going to yeah. maybe go for coffee once a month and check in, or maybe I'll call you. But mm-hmm. the social media thing could, that could be something you don't look at.
Yeah, yeah. And everybody's different. The same way we said, like, doing non-monogamy is like, you're creating it in a unique way to you, is like mm-hmm. you can also create what that relationship mm-hmm. now looks like yeah. in a unique mm-hmm. way to yourself yeah. as well. I mean, this whole episode, I think, can feel really intimidating if you just clicked on it mm-hmm. to be like, oh, I'm interested in just exploring an open relationship with my partner. And now we're talking about all of these, like, really big concepts of, like, unpacking monogamy and all of these things. And perhaps, like, you do feel like your partner, you're owed the ability to have, like, hierarchy, and you're owed the ability to place rules on your partner and all these things, and you're feeling really, like, potentially, like, a little triggered by the conversation and, like, ooh, distant from it. What do you do right now?
The ethics of polyamory are transferable to monogamy, mm-hmm. and I think that they would improve the old scripts of monogamy that are at times toxic, mm-hmm. like the ownership mm-hmm. notion. I own this person. They're my property. If you need to control somebody else's behavior to feel a sense of safety, mm-hmm. then you got to work on your sense of safety, mm-hmm. not somebody else's behavior. Because yeah. that person could betray you, right? That's the True. Whole basis of cheating, is you give somebody some kind of rule that they find to be suffocating, even if they agree that that's not something they want to do. Mm-hmm. But when they're told by someone else with authority, or like an authoritative stance, that they can't do the thing, mm-hmm. they might do it just to spite you, just because their freedom's been mm-hmm. Suffocated by you. So there's no guarantee that you trying to put out a rule for somebody else's behavior is going to work out. It could backfire horribly. Go back into the self. What do you need? What needs aren't being met for you?
Yeah.
And how can you find a healthy way of having those needs met?
I would say definitely unpack those before you begin. Yeah. Otherwise, yes. I think it would save you just a lot of pain and suffering.
Ask yourself what you really want and don't be scared of the answer.
I think yeah. that's a good place to end it then.
Wonderful, yes.
Where can people find you? How can they find therapy?
Is there something yeah. like a polyamory therapy
group?
Collective, perhaps? Group? You know what? Maybe some wow. polyamorous queer therapists in the city could start yeah. something like a
polyamory therapy collective.
With polyamory group therapy, an 8-week program where you can resolve all kinds of issues that
Thank
are
Thank you so much for opening the space for this pitch.
We should start on April 3rd, yeah. every Thursday from 6:30 to 8 p.m. alloveyou.ca/events to register.
There's the pitch, folks.
So that's everything that we have for you today. And if you want to dive deeper into dipping your little toesies into polyamory, we have an episode with Yaz. It's called Polyamory: Everything That You Need to Know But We're Too Afraid to Ask. Make sure to like, comment, and subscribe. And if you're listening on your favorite podcast app, make sure to leave us a 5-star review, because it really does help the podcast out. That's everything that we got. And until next time,
peace.
Peace.